For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It is
18th.
August the 18th. We are back in business. Parashas Mishpatim, page 416. Ve'elam Mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem. These are the laws. It says in English, the ordinances that you shall place before them. And this is going now to kick off a whole list of different laws. We as a group have not had this yet. We have learned from Bereishis until here. We've had a few laws here and there, particularly when we learned about the Karban Pesach, the Pesach offering. We had a whole bunch of laws over there. But here we're going to have almost a whole parsha of various types of laws. And we'll discuss them as they come up. Now it says, these are the laws that you shall place before them. Asher tasim lifneihem, place before them. It could have said, Asher tomar lohem, that you shall tell them. Asher titain lohem, that you shall give them.
Teach them.
Or Asher talamdem, you shall teach them.
But tagid.
Tagid, okay. It says, Asher tasim lifneihem, you shall place before them. It's a funny way to talk about laws. If you're talking to me about an item of some sort, a physical item, you can say you place it before him. Take the item. Like later on, we'll talk about bikurim, the first fruits that you bring to the Beis HaMikdash, and you place them down in the Beis HaMikdash. That makes sense. But here, what is he placing? He's telling us about laws. It's a funny way to talk about laws. It is from here that our sages derive, and Rashi cites it, that the laws of the Torah should not be taught as dry lists of laws. A, B, C, D, E, F. This. Which will be a whole bunch of rules and without any understanding of them. But rather, they should be placed in front of the people. Placing means, as Rashi explains, like a shulchan aruch, like a set table, which is ready to, when you place food in front of a person, the table is all set. Your guests are seated. And now you bring the food out from the kitchen, and you serve it to them, you place it in front of them, it's all ready to eat, to be consumed, and to be enjoyed. And so Hashem is telling Moshe, don't just rattle off a bunch of laws to the Jewish people. Don't even tell it to them three or four times so they memorize it. The Torah is not meant to be a list that we memorize out of rote. The Torah is meant to be something that we explain and we delve into and we enjoy and we understand and we grasp. And that's the idea of Asher tasim lifneihem, place it before them like a set table where they're ready to indulge, ready to eat, ready to enjoy. That's the way the Torah is meant to be taught. The Torah is not meant to be taught as just a list of rules. Do this, don't do that. That's not the way Torah is ever meant to be taught. Sometimes, when we don't know what to do, and we're asking a question, what should we do? So we need to know, do this, don't do that. But the way the Torah is meant to be taught is with the explanation, with the depth of what the Torah is all about. That's what Moshe was told to tell the people. And that's the way Torah has always been taught for generations. It's always been taught in depth and with understanding. The most recent pasuk at the end of Parshas Yisro was, in the previous page, "V'losalev malos al mizbechi." Do not go on steps up to my altar. "Ashalosigal arvascha alav," that your nakedness should not be revealed upon it. Then we follow that with "Ve'ela mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem." These are the laws that you shall place before them. The Gemara, this is going to sound like some sort of a contemporary, fanciful way of reading the Chumash. But this is actually a Gemara itself that says this. The Gemara says that the reason why the two verses are placed next to each other is to tell you, "Velo sale v'malos al mizbechi." Don't go up the steps. When you go up steps, the image that brings up in your mind is someone who is, you know, moving up. So Hashem is telling Moshe to tell the judges that when you judge a court case, don't leap up the steps when you're judging a case. Rather, take it slowly. Take it with patience. Take it with understanding. Don't jump to conclusions when you are judging a court case. Even if you've heard the case, the similar case, many times before, every case needs to be examined all over again to make sure you've got it right. Talking to a judge, that when you are judging a case and you have litigants in front of you, make sure you don't rush through it and rush to judgment. Make sure you've got all the facts straight and you've interrogated the witnesses. Make sure you go everything the way you, step by step, the way it's meant to be, and don't jump ahead. So, what are the first set of laws that we're going to talk about over here? And that is going to be the law of slavery. We know that there are two types of slaves. There is a Jewish slave and a non-Jewish slave. We are going to first talk here about Jewish slaves. Non-Jewish slaves are not spoken about here. They're spoken about much later in the Chumash. So we're going to focus our attention here about Jewish slavery. That means Jew owning a Jew. Ki sikne eved ivri, when you shall purchase a Jewish slave. Sheish shanim ya'avod, he shall work for 6 years. Uvashvias, and in the 7th year, yetze lachavshi chinam, he shall go out to freedom for free. So he goes out to freedom. That's self-explanatory. For free. There's no charge for him to leave the master's ownership after 6 years. Im bigapo yavo, bigapo yetze. If he comes, now literally this means in his cloak. How do they translate it here? By himself. Well, that's the understanding of it. Bigapo meaning only in his cloak. He's got no other dependents. If he comes into slavery by himself, then he goes out of slavery by himself. Imbal ishahu, if he is the husband of a wife, viyatza ishto imo, then his wife goes out with him from slavery. Ima donav yitelo isha, if his master shall give him a wife, viyoldalo vanimo vanos, and she bears for him sons or daughters, ha ishavi ladeha, the wife and her children, tiyela doneha, shall be to her master. The who, and he, the slave, yetze v'gapo, will go out by himself. V'im amor yomar ha'evin, if the slave shall say, ahavti es adoni, I loved my master, et ishti, my wife, es vanai, and my children. Lo yetze chavshi, I do not want to go out. I will not go out for free. I will not go out to freedom. V'higisho adonav el ho'elohim, and his master shall bring him close to the court. Here the word Elohim does not mean God. Usually the word Elohim means God. In this context it does not mean that. It means the court. How could the same word mean God and mean court? Because the word Elohim only means power. That's what it means. Usually when we talk about power, we're talking about the one who has all the power, which is God. In which case we say Elohim. But here it's referring to the local authority, which is the court. So he shall bring him close to the court. V'higisho el hadelas, and bring him close to the door. O el hamezuzah, or to the doorpost. V'ratza adonav es ozno ba'martzea, and his master shall pierce his ear with a martzea. A martzea is a sharp awl, it says over there. Okay.
What's an awl?
An awl is a sharp.
A big nail.
Nail, right.
Okay. Fine. Thank you.
Va'avado le'olam, and he will be his slave forever. So, just to make it very clear to everybody in this room, that when a man has a pierced ear, it is a sign of slavery. Mm-hmm. Let's just make it very clear. Okay. Yes.
Am I remembering right that the 6 years, it's really until Shemitah, and that's when they do it? Or
no, it, no, it no, is...
It's a real 6 years.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They have to really keep track of when
right. Each slave has a different... Right. Yovel would interrupt it, but it will tell them. Okay. Okay.
Not okay.
Rabbi, let me ask you. You release a man from his family, and there's no choice. You're saying they just... He has to remain a slave to stay with his family.
With which family?
The wife and the children.
Okay, so we're going to discuss that. It's a very good question. Good. Now, this discussion so far is only speaking about a male Jewish slave, a Jew who purchases a male Jew as a slave. This is not referring to a female. That is the next set of verses, is if a Jew purchases a female Jewess as a slave. That's a different discussion. We're not up to that yet, and that has a whole different approach. But this is the male slave. Now, there are two ways in which a man can be sold, a Jewish man can be sold into slavery to a fellow Jew. There are two ways it can happen. One is a man is in extreme poverty, sees no way of making a living, and no one will hire him. Perhaps he doesn't have skills for which it's worthwhile to hire him. Perhaps his work ethic isn't great, whatever it is, but he can't find work. And the only way he sees that he can make a livelihood is to sell himself as a slave. And it is permitted for a Jew to sell himself as a slave. Now, it does mean, though, that he is stuck. See, an employee can always quit. And in fact, we have rules, we have halachos, we have laws that govern employer-employee relationships that allow an employee to quit his job. Because an employee is not a slave. And that's the primary difference between an employee and a slave. An employee can walk away. If he doesn't like the job that you have offered him, if he doesn't like the way you're treating him, if he doesn't like the conditions of the job, he can simply say, I'm done. And he can walk away. That is always the right of the employee. He can always walk away. Now, there are circumstances in which when an employee walks away from a job, it hurts the employer to the point where he loses money because there's no one else to hire at that time. And there are laws governing that as well, because then he forces a loss onto the employer. But the right to walk away from a job is an employee's right, always. A slave cannot walk away from the job. Once he's a slave, he's stuck for a minimum of 6 years. So if a person decides to sell himself into slavery, he has now made himself stuck as a slave for 6 years, unless something happens to get him out of slavery. We'll discuss what might be the options to get out of slavery. But the default is he is stuck as a slave for at least 6 years. So he could sell himself. It is an option. The other way, and the more common way, for a Jewish man, to be sold as a slave to a fellow Jew would be if he steals money and is unable to pay. He steals, he's convicted of theft or burglary or whatever it is, and now he cannot pay for what he stole. In that case, the court sells him into slavery, and the purchase price is the value of what he stole. So that, let's explain this. If a man sells himself into slavery because he's poor, so what will happen is they will evaluate what his value is as a slave. That's, you know, they'll put him on the slave market and figure out what does he cost, what is a man like this with his strength and his ability to work, whatever it is. What would a master pay to own such a person? And there's a going rate, there's a value. So he'll pay that money, and then that money will be this slave's money for when he gets out of slavery. He'll have some money in the bank. If he steals, so let's say he stole a car. He stole somebody's car. The car is valued at $10,000, and he stole the car. And when he stole the car, he drove it and he wrecked it. And he can't afford to pay the $10,000 that he stole. So now, based in, the court will sell him into slavery. The purchase price will be $10,000.
Yeah.
That money will pay back the the victim of his theft, and he will work it off for the next 6 years.
What if nobody has the amount of money that?
Then there's no one to do it. That's a good point. If there is no one to do it, there's no one to do it. It could be that Beis Din will try to convince someone to do it, but you're right. If there's no one to do it, there's no one to do it. Let's explain just before we do that. The only debt for which we sell someone into slavery is a debt that is incurred through theft.
Yes.
If a person borrows your car, now if a person borrows an object and wrecks it, he has to pay for it. So if a person borrows someone else's car and wrecks the car, he owes him money. He owes him $10,000. If he cannot pay, he will not be sold into slavery, because that's not theft. It's only for theft that we will then sell someone into slavery. For damages, for negligence, things of that nature, he'll owe them money, but we will not sell a person into slavery. It's only for theft that we will do it. Yeah?
What bothers me is, you know, the Torah is talking about history. How do you adapt that to modern society?
Okay, good. So it's hard to know, because in modern society we don't have a court system that runs the country. So we can't impose this on modern society. However, once the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt and we have a government that is founded on Torah law, we'll see. I don't know if slavery will come back into existence or not. It depends on whether slavery is an inherent matter, whether it's something which really is embedded in society, or whether it has to do with how people act. The fact of the matter is that with selling into slavery, as we're describing over here, this, as we will see, is not really what you and I picture as slavery. That's the thing. So this type of slavery likely will come back into practice, but it's not exactly the way we picture it. And we'll see how many differences there are between our classic picture of slavery, I imagine we all have the same picture, is the black slaves in America before 1865. That's or 1860, whenever the Emancipation Proclamation was. So that's our picture of slavery, which is a pretty harsh version of slavery. And what we're describing here is a completely different type of quote-unquote slavery. It is slavery in the sense that the slave cannot walk away from the job, he can't quit, and he must do what his master orders him to do, but the master is very limited, as we will see, in what he can order the slave to do. And that's what we're going to describe. It's not wholesale slavery in the sense that the master has complete control over a human being. So those are the two reasons why slavery can happen: a Jew purchasing a fellow Jew, male. This particular part of the Torah is discussing when a man is sold into slavery because he stole and cannot repay. That happens to be what we're talking about over here. Later in the Chumash, there's a discussion about someone who sells himself into slavery. Now, he is sold for 6 years. Those 6 years, as Dina was just discussing, they are individual to the particular slave. So if a slave is sold in 2010, he works until 2016. If he's sold in 2011, he works until 2017. It just depends on the particular slave. The Torah says that when he goes at the end of the seventh year, Pasuk Beis in verse 7, in the seventh year he will go out lachafshi. He'll go to freedom, chinam, for free. There's no charge for him to leave. Now, here, the Chumash doesn't tell you anything more than that. Later on in the Chumash, we are told another law, and this is what we're going to find. This is something which we're not used to, because we've been reading primarily about stories. When we read about laws, the Torah doesn't necessarily put all the rules for the law in one place. You could have a mitzvah, the Torah talks about a little bit over here, a little bit over there. For instance, Shabbos. Shabbos the Torah speaks about plenty of times. And the laws of Shabbos are derived by putting together all the different places that the Torah speaks about Shabbos. With slavery, the Torah speaks about it a few times. And one of the laws of going free is not mentioned over here, it's mentioned later on. What is that law? That's the law of the mitzvah of Ha'anaka. Ha'anaka is the mitzvah that the owner, when the slave goes free, is required to give the slave gifts as he leaves. And the gifts are not up to the master's discretion. There are specific rules for how much he must give the slave. The point being that when you free a slave has nothing. And if you're going to free him, then what have you freed him to do? You essentially have freed him to
steal again.
To steal again, or to sell himself as a slave. What else is he supposed to do? He goes back into society as an unemployed, penniless person. So what have you done for him? So the Torah doesn't allow that. When the master allows the slave to go free after 6 years, which he must do, he also must give him a pretty significant parting gift, which will set the slave up into normative society in a way that he can now get himself on his feet. Yeah.
So if a slave gets married and he has children and he says, I don't want to leave, I want to stay with you, they put a hole in his ear and he's there forever as a slave. What happens to his children?
Good. Okay. We're going to get to that in a minute. Okay, we're about to tackle that part. We're still dealing here with this first, but you're absolutely right. What happens to the children then? Okay. Now, the word for freedom is chafshi. Yetzei la chafshi chinam. Now you may be familiar with that word. Chafshi. Anybody familiar with that word?
Someone who's not from?
No. No. No.
All right. Oh, I think chilani. Okay, never mind.
What's
chofesh? Chofesh means like a vacation.
Yeah.
Right? Chofesh means like a vacation. And if I'm not mistaken, in the Israeli national anthem, what is the language? Isn't it to be chofshi? Yeah. Isn't it chofshi? Right? Free? Chofshi. There are two words for freedom in the Torah. There is chofesh or chafshi, which it says over here. But interestingly, this is not the word used for the classic example of slaves going free in the Torah. What's the classic example of slaves going free in the Torah?
The Exodus.
The Exodus. When we left Egypt, weren't we a bunch of slaves going free? It doesn't use the word chafshi. It uses the word chayrus. Another word for freedom. What's the difference between the word chayrus and the word chafshi? Chafshi means freedom as we tend to think about it in our American mindset. Free! The shackles of the master have been thrown off and I am free to do as I please. That's what chafshi means. Chayrus doesn't mean that. Chayrus means I have been able to get away from that master, but I have entered a state of responsibility. As the Torah says, we went from being slaves to Paro to becoming slaves to
Hashem.
Because ultimately, the purpose of getting away from Paro was not to do as we please. The purpose was to leave Paro and go get the Torah, which would tell us how to behave. That's what a Jew is supposed to do. So we went from Paro's being enslaved to Paro to being enslaved by Hashem. Of course, it's a completely different enslavement. We want to be enslaved by Hashem. We really are enslaved by Hashem, whether we know it or not. Whether we want to or not, the entire human race is enslaved by Hashem because He's in total control. But the Jews, as we left Egypt, we took on we accepted the yoke of heaven. Here, He's throwing off the shackles of this master and not taking on a different master. Why? Isn't he a slave to Hashem? But he's a slave to Hashem when he's with the master also. He's a Jew, and he's a slave to a Jew. So that never changed. He always was under the yoke of heaven. The master's under the yoke of heaven. The slave's under the yoke of heaven. That's not changing. What's changing is he's throwing off the yoke of the master and not taking a different master in his place. That's why the word chafshi is used here, because it's complete freedom from that particular slavery. Yeah?
When a boy becomes bar mitzvah, is he called Heirus? Is he referred to? You know,
no, we don't use.
He's
no.
Some responsibility.
No, No, because it would be responsibility of the country. I mean, it is a freedom. It's freedom from Paro. There is a freedom that comes in. The word cheres does imply a freedom, but it's a freedom that moves into a level of responsibility. Now, let's move into what's bothering everybody, which is this business of the wife and children, etc. So, Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, in Begapo Yavo, if he comes in by himself, Begapo Yetze, then he goes out by himself. So that's hard to understand. Obviously, if he came in by himself, then he goes out by himself. What else would there be? How could he, if he came in by himself, what else, who else is there to free besides him if he came in by himself?
Wife and children.
What wife and children? He came in by himself.
Yeah, but he had them after he was a slave.
Okay, so the implication is that any wife and children he would have after he became a slave, they won't go free. Okay? But we're going to come back to that. Imbal Ishahu, if he is a husband of a wife, which means prior to becoming a slave, he had a wife. V'yatsa Ishto Imo, his wife goes out with him. Our sages ask, what do you mean his wife goes out with him? When did she become a slave that she would now go out with him? That doesn't make any sense. He's the slave, not her. So what do you mean if he is married when he becomes a slave, then when he's freed, his wife is also freed? Freed from what? She wasn't a slave. To which our sages explain that when a man purchases a Jewish slave, obviously you know that if you own a slave, you are responsible for that human being's basic needs. You've got to feed him. You've got to clothe him. You've got to give him a bed. You've got to give him a roof over his head. You've got to give him adequate heating and cooling, whatever is necessary. You got to give him sanitary facilities, or you got to give him whatever he needs. When a Jewish man purchases another Jewish man, if the slave came into slavery with a family, he's got a wife and children. That wife and children are free, of course. They don't become slaves, but the master is now responsible to support the wife and the children of his slave. You realize this is becoming an extremely expensive proposition. Right? You don't buy a slave if you're living on a your week-to-week paycheck. You buy a slave only if you have the kind of money that you can support a whole other household. If this slave comes in and he's got a wife and four or five children, you now have to support his wife and four or five children. That's a pretty hefty responsibility. So the Torah tells us that when the slave goes free, his wife also goes free, which means that the master is no longer responsible for the wife of the slave. Once he goes free, the master is done supporting the wife. So he has purchased, when he purchases the slave, he purchases 6 years of supporting the wife and children. There are anybody who knows anybody who unfortunately, where a man has unfortunately been incarcerated for whatever reason. You may know a person or two who are like that. When that happens in a highly unfortunate situation, there's nothing to take care of the family. Right. You know, the wife, the children, and there's no government support. That the person is a criminal, the person's locked up, wife and children have to fend for themselves. There's no help for them. The Torah does not recognize that as an acceptable way for a Jew to be sold to a fellow Jew. The master has to support the wife and children as well.
So does the wife also have to work?
No. The wife does not work for the master. Only, this whole discussion is only with a male slave. There is no situation where an adult female can be sold into slavery. It does not exist in the Torah. Adult female Jewess can be sold into slavery. It does not exist. We'll see later that there is an example of a minor female. We'll talk about that later. But an adult female, there is no such thing. So here we have the support of the wife and the children while he is a slave. Now the analogy to jail time, to incarceration, is actually very real because the Torah doesn't have incarceration. We don't jail people. There are only, as far as I know, there are only two examples of incarceration in the Torah. Only two that I know of. One, I should say three. There's three. There is one case in the Torah where there is two different people that they did an Avera for which they had to be put to death. One worked on Shabbos, the other one blasphemed. He cursed God. And the Torah tells how they were put to death. In both cases, the Jews did not know either how to put them to death or whether they should put them to death. So they were incarcerated till the Jews found out what to do. But that's not a law for the future. That was just for that time because they didn't know. They weren't told yet by Hashem what to do. So they had to lock the people up. That was one example. Another example is, according to one opinion, there is one example of capital punishment where the perpetrator needs to be put to death when all the Jews are together. When are all the Jews together? During one of the three major holidays. The Shalosh Regalim, either Pesach or Sukkot or Shavuos. That's when the Jews come together in Yerushalayim. So according to one opinion, in the case of the Zakein Mamre, the elder who rebels against the high court, rebels against the Sanhedrin, and he has to be put to death, according to one opinion, he is held in prison until all the Jews are together, and then he's put to death. Obviously a very unusual situation. The only other case of incarceration that I'm aware of in the Torah is where a person physically assaulted somebody else, and it is unclear whether the victim is going to recover or not. If the victim recovers, then the aggressor is obligated to pay for all of his expenses, medical bills, loss of work, embarrassment, all the different types of, it's a very, very expensive proposition. He's got to pay for it. But he lives. If the victim dies, then the aggressor is a murderer and is put to death. So in that case, we lock him up to see what will happen, to see whether the victim is going to recover or die. Because if the victim dies, we then will put the aggressor to death. If the victim recovers, we will let the aggressor go free, but he'll have to pay. So incarceration in the Torah is really only a holding place in order to find out something else. There is no punishment of jail time. We don't believe in that in the Torah, to lock someone up as a form of punishment. This is the closest thing we have. That the person couldn't pay, he stole, he couldn't pay, so we don't lock him up, but we sell him as a slave to pay off his debt. That's the closest thing we have to jail time. Otherwise, we don't have jails. We don't believe in that form of punishment. Punishment in the Torah is either capital punishment, corporal punishment, payment, and offering of karbanos, of offerings to the Beis HaMikdash. Those are the types of punishments we have in the Torah. We don't have jail time as punishment in the Torah. Yeah. Yeah, but there's no, the punishment that's meted out is either payment or lashes, death, or having to bring in a carbon. We don't have...
We have on records all the examples of,
Oh, we're going to learn a lot about it here. Well, as we'll see.
We have call 1-800-BAD-DRUG.
Bad what? Okay. Fine. So if he is taken as a slave, the master now has to support the wife and children, and when the slave goes free, then the wife is no longer supported by the master. Now she is supported by her husband, by the slave, former slave. Pasuk Dalet, verse 4. Im Adonav yiten lo isha, if his master will give him a wife, v'yalda lo vanim o vanos, and she will have for him sons or daughters, ha'isha biladeh tiel adoneha, the wife and the children shall remain with the master, v'hu, and he the slave, Yetzei v'gapo, will go out by himself. From what does it mean that the master will give to the slave a wife? Well, we just finished saying before that there is no example of an adult Jewish woman. Now, an adult means over the age of 12. There's no example of an adult Jewish woman being a slave. We don't have that in the Torah. So who exactly is this master giving to the slave as a wife.
Non-Jewish.
A non-Jewish slave.
So how does he happen to own a non-Jewish?
We're going to talk about that later. But the Torah recognizes non-Jewish slaves as well. This is just Jewish slaves. But there is also non-Jewish slaves. That's a different discussion. But we do know that it exists. Non-Jewish slaves can be both men and women. So the master here owns a non-Jewish female slave. He is permitted to take that non-Jewish female slave and give her to the Jewish slave as a wife. What would be the purpose in doing that? Purpose in doing that would be to produce more slaves. If they have children, those children remain with the master, as does the female slave. Because a non-Jewish slave owned by a Jew does not go free after 6 years. The non-Jewish slave is owned perpetually. And therefore, the master here is taking a woman slave who he owns perpetually, giving her to the Jewish slave, but the Jewish slave is only his slave for 6 years. And she becomes his wife for 6 years. Does it use the word wife? It says, And any children that are produced remain with the master. After 6 years, the Jewish slave goes free, and the non-Jewish slave, the woman, and the children remain with the master. They do not go free with him. Now, we're going to have a provision. What happens if he wants to stay? That's the next thing, about being the pierced ear and all that. But the default is that he leaves, that she stays, and the kids stay, and he leaves. Now, our sages tell us the following. Remember before we read that if he comes in by himself, he leaves by himself. Our sages say as follows. If a man becomes, a Jewish man, becomes a slave, and when he enters slavery, he is single, he does not have a wife, then the master is not allowed to give him a female slave to be his wife. May not do that. If he comes in by himself, he leaves by himself. There may not be any relationship with a non-Jewish slave. It is only the slave who, when he became a slave, was married to a free Jewish woman. That slave, the master has the right to give him a non-Jewish slave in order to produce children. Now, why would that be? What's the difference between the man who has a family and the man who doesn't have a family? What would you say?
The whole thing is
firstborn
to begin with.
Yeah.
What?
I mean, it's like a factory.
It is. But let's understand. What's the difference between the person who has a family and doesn't have a family?
Responsibility.
Responsibility is true. That's true. How about incentive?
There's no incentive. I mean,
listen,
you're a slave. Have to do the 6 years.
At the end of 6 years, he goes free.
Yeah.
Right? Will he want to leave the master at the end of 6 years? Most sane people will want to leave.
Right?
If you only became a slave because you were hard up on money or because you stole and you couldn't pay back, so you were sold. Most people, though, as soon as 6 years are over, I'm out of here. I'm not staying. But if a person didn't have a wife to go back to, and when he became a slave, he was given a wife, will he want to leave? He has a strong incentive to remain a slave. He doesn't want to go back. The Torah says, that's not permitted. We do not want to give him incentive to remain with his master at the end of 6 years. Therefore, the only one who the master is allowed to make use out of to produce more slaves is only with someone who has a wife to go back to. Then, giving him the non-Jewish slave is not going to give him an incentive to stay, although the Torah is going to talk about what happens if he wants to. But this way, there is an incentive to leave the master.
But doesn't his wife come with him?
No, she doesn't become a slave.
I know she doesn't become a slave, but she's with him under the...
Yeah, I mean...
Is she in the household of the master?
She can be.
Well, there must be. You're so biased there.
Well, listen.
That's what I'm saying is if he's married and she's with him, he still has to go with this woman that the master gave him?
The master would have to take that into account. Listen, remember, the Torah does allow polygamy. Right?
Right.
I mean, it's not like this is not a prohibited thing to do. But you're right that it does create a certain...
Suppose the non-Jewish woman converts to Judaism.
She can't. The non-Jewish woman is a slave.
And she can't convert to Judaism.
No. Well, let's explain that for a moment. Let's take a step out of this. I know that people have questions on this. But let's take a step. Let's just explain the status of this non-Jewish woman. We haven't learned about it yet, so we're going to learn about it later. When the Torah will talk about non-Jewish slaves. That's men and women, non-Jewish slaves. A non-Jewish slave is a funny sort of situation which we don't have today. It's an unusual middle ground which we don't have today. We know there are Jews and there are non-Jews. We're familiar with that concept. We know that Jews are to marry Jews and non-Jews are to marry non-Jews. We know there's a concept of conversion where a non-Jew can become a Jew. We know that it doesn't work the other way. A Jew cannot become a non-Jew. We're familiar with that. Okay. Normally, conversion, first of all, is discouraged. And the reason why we discourage conversion is because we want to make sure that the potential convert is sincere. We're always afraid that the person is insincere. We want to make sure, because being Jewish is not necessarily easy. We want to make sure that the person really wants it. So we discourage conversion. That's number one. Number two, conversion is voluntary. We do not proselytize. And in contrast to most other religions, we do not go out and seek converts. They can come and join if they wish, but we do not seek it. So it's completely voluntary. A non-Jew who is owned by a Jew then goes through a forced conversion. A non-Jewish slave owned by a Jew is not really not Jewish. It's not fully Jewish either. He's kind of in the middle. He's not a full-fledged Jew because he's a slave. But he's also not a non-Jew either because he's undergone a forced conversion. If this non-Jewish slave, I use the word non-Jewish in quotations because he's not really fully non-Jewish anymore. If this slave later attains his freedom, now he doesn't go free after 6 years, but there are other ways that a non-Jewish slave can go free. Not the same way that a Jewish slave can go free, it's different. We'll learn about it later. If he attains his freedom, he is no longer a slave. What is he? Is he Jew or non-Jew? He's a full-fledged Jew. Follow? A man who is not Jewish. I'll give you one example for how a non-Jewish, the primary example for how a non-Jew can become a slave. You know how a non-Jew becomes a slave? He is in an army that attacks the Jews, and he is taken prisoner of war. What do you do with a POW, anyway? It's very difficult. What do you do with POWs? A POW is the most difficult thing for an army to deal with. You got to feed them, you got to clothe them, and they hate your guts. What do you do with them? So it depends on the country that you are from. In many countries, what you do with POWs is you slaughter them. You just kill them. Or you put them through slave labor until they die. Because they're a pain. They are they hate you. We don't want them to, you know. You can't give them back. If you send them back, they're going to turn around and rearm them and they're going to fight you again.
Yeah, so, just did that.
Right, what do you do with them? So what are you going to lock them in jail? And then you're going to have to pay for them for the rest of their lives? What do you do with them? So the Torah says that a POW becomes a slave. Okay. Now he's your slave. So this man, he was attacking the Jewish nation. He was captured. And now he becomes a slave owned by the Jewish people, owned by a Jew. He has to undergo a forced conversion. He is now a slave. He has rights as well. It's not wholesale, whatever the master wants. He has rights. It's not the same as a Jewish slave, but there are rights that he has. We'll talk about that another time. And he has to work for the Jew. at a certain point in time, either because the master chose to let him go free, or because he was mistreated, he then goes free. When he goes free, he is now a Jew. He's no longer a non-Jew. He's a Jew. He has gone from being not Jewish to being a middle ground slave kind of thing to being Jewish. That's what happens when he goes free. So this non-Jewish slave woman that is owned by a Jew, when we say she's not Jewish, we don't mean in the classic sense, like out there on the street, a non-Jewish woman. We mean a woman who was not Jewish before she became a slave, and now she's in this middle ground. She's undergone a forced conversion, but she's still a slave. And she's not a Jewish slave, she's a non-Jewish slave. It's kind of in the middle. This is the woman who we're talking about, that the master has the prerogative to give her to the Jewish slave to produce more slaves who will be in that middle ground category, who will be neither non-Jewish nor Jewish. They're going to be in the middle over there. If they ever attain their freedom, they will be Jewish, like any other convert. That's what they will be. A freed slave, a freed non-Jewish slave, has the same status as a convert. They are always lumped together in Jewish law. And that's what happens with a freed slave. That's what we're talking about over here. Okay, now that we understand what we're talking about, even though it may not sit well with us, but at least we understand the facts. Yeah. And they've all read it. They all know it. Listen, there's no question that we treated slaves far better than anybody else ever treated slaves. Our slaves have rights.
You can't
molest them. You can't beat them. There's all kinds of rules that govern the master and slave relationship. And, you know, there were no such rules in other societies. Yeah.
Would Hagar have been considered a slave?
Yes. She was a slave until Sarah gave her up to Avram as a wife.
So now she's Jewish.
That's right. But remember, that was before the Torah was given, so the rules are a little bit different. But she was no longer a slave once Avram marries her.
Was she considered Jewish then, or she was considered Jewish later when she chose to convert?
I'm not sure, because Judaism, the definition of Judaism then was different than today. As we've mentioned this many times, that until the Torah was given, the way you became Jewish was, there was no Judaism, it was a family. We were the children of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So how you become part of a family? You marry into the family. That's how you become part of the family. So when a non-Jew married into the Jewish clan, they became part of the family. Now, what did they have to, what were the requirements for them to be able to marry in? Well, they had to be righteous, they had to display the right kind of traits in order to be able to marry in. The once the Torah is given, there are two things that change. First of all, marriage does not make a person Jewish. It's just the opposite. You're not allowed to marry without first converting. They have to convert. So that's number one. But number two, now there is a formalized method of conversion that does not include marriage. A person can convert and not marry. They're still Jewish. You don't have to marry in order to be Jewish. You just have to convert. It's a whole different process now than it was then. So it's hard to compare how Hagar became part of the Jewish people and how it happens today. But she did become part of the Jewish people at that point when Abraham married her.
I'm a little confused. So a free Jewish slave has the status of a convert.
A free Jewish slave is back to the way he was before. He's Jewish.
A free non-Jewish slave has the status of a convert.
Yes.
But he's free. Only when they're free.
He's in between while he's still the slave in the family. And once he's out...
Yeah. So does he have to serve the 6 full years?
The non-Jewish slave does not have a time limit on his slavery. There are ways for him to go free, but it's not based on time. We'll see later. If he's mistreated, he goes free. If the master chooses to let him go free, he can go free. But it's not based on 6 years. Yeah.
When the in-between one goes free and then is considered Jewish, what if that person never accepted anything into this. Do they have the choice?
No, they don't have the choice.
Once you're Jewish, you're Jewish.
Right, they don't have the choice. The master is not supposed to let the slave go free if there is a suspicion that the slave will not accept his new status. Right? But that is, sometimes it happens anyway, because if he mistreats him, he's going to go free no matter what. That's one of the consequences for mistreating a slave. One of the ways that we protect slaves, what's the most effective way of protecting a slave? The most effective way of protecting a slave is you threaten the master. If you beat him, you will lose him, because we're going to give him his freedom. You know how much money that is?
Yep.
If you're treating a person as a piece of property, it's a very expensive piece of property. Can you imagine if we said, listen, instead of having all the insurance, you know, auto insurance and all that, can you imagine if we said that if a person exceeds the speed limit, then we take away his car? If that were the punishment for exceeding, well, most people wouldn't exceed the speed limit. That's a pretty hefty fine to pay, right? If you mistreat it, then you can't have it. That's what we tell masters of slaves. If you're going to mistreat him, we're going to take away the slave, and he's going to go free. So that was a very large incentive to be very careful with how they treated the slaves. Yeah.
So the slave can go to a court and say, my master is beating me?
Yeah. Yeah, they could be able to go to court, sure. Sure. They had rights. They had rights. They didn't go free like a Jewish slave goes free after 6 years, but they had rights.
So in that period of time, someone with small debts, the person that the debts go to had to think twice before he takes on a slave and his family.
Oh, yeah. It was not. For small debts, you wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
It would have to be a really, really high debt in order to. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if the non-Jewish female slave has children with a Jewish slave, and then the Jewish slave leaves and she's there with the children, and she gets her freedom for whatever reason, can her children go with
Okay,
her?
So that's a question in general. That has nothing to do with this particular case. I mean, you can have whole families of slaves, all non-Jewish. Mm-hmm. What if one of them goes free? What happens then to the rest of the family? That's a good question. I'm actually not 100% sure how that works, and we can talk about that when we get to non-Jewish slaves. But the father, which is the Jewish slave, he really goes free because this is not meant to be a permanent relationship. That's the whole point over here. We don't want it to be a permanent relationship. We don't want him to remain with this non-Jewish slave. We don't want him to remain with the master. We want him after 6 years to leave. And therefore, that's why we mentioned before, he's got to be married to a Jewish woman in order for the master to give him the non-Jewish slave in order to produce more slaves. But it's got to be, because we don't want this to be a permanent relationship.
He doesn't want them.
Yeah.
Okay, he may not have a choice in this. That may be, if I'm understanding correctly, and this I'm not sure about, but you see, if I'm understanding correctly, this is considered to be another way of serving the master. Which you're pointing out, it doesn't sound nice, but that is is considered to be another method of servitude. It's one of the ways a slave. It's one of the. This is one of the negatives of being a slave. A slave is not a nice thing, right? And that's one of the negatives. Yeah.
So this Jewish slave has a family, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he has, let's say, a wife and three kids. And he did something bad, he becomes a slave, so he is given a non-Jewish woman as a slave. So what I'm thinking is that Hashem thinks that would be a reason to bond the man to this particular family, as opposed to not bond him.
If he has his own family to go back to,
he has two families.
I think he's less inclined to stay. He has what to go back to.
2%, 5%, 10%.
Then why would he want to?
What?
Then why would he want to?
Why would he want to what?
Stay.
No, you're right. No, there is the contingency, which we're about to read right now. There is the possibility he will want to stay. It's true. There is the possibility. But it's less likely.
Possibility. If you don't want him to stay,
I don't know. I don't know. For a man, to have to go back.
He has a wife.
He's got a free wife and children. I mean, you know, he's got a kid becoming bar mitzvah. He's got. I mean, you know,
confusing.
Okay, now.
He hasn't seen them in 6 years.
We're almost out of time. No. He can see them. He can see them.
Oh.
He can see them. It's not.
Can he have conjugal visits?
I'm not sure. That was what I was asked before. I'm not sure. I don't know how that works. That's a good question. I don't know how that works with the current wife. I'll have to look that up, Mr. Shen, for next time. So now, then we have this discussion of that he says, no, I want to stay. Even though he's got a wife and children to go back to, no, I want to stay with the slave with whom I am paired up with now. I like my master. I like my wife, meaning my slave wife, and I like my children. I don't want to go free. So if he says that, then the master takes him to court, and they put him up to the door,
and
the doorpost, and they pierce his ear, and then he becomes a slave forever. Now the word forever, this is important, does not mean forever. It means until Yovel. Yovel is every 50 years. Yovel is the Jubilee year. It's every 50 years. So all this means is that he becomes a slave until the Jubilee year, until the Yovel year, whenever it happens. So that means that if his sixth year came out to be in the fifth year of the Yovel cycle, and then he becomes a Nirtza, he gets his ear pierced, then he will remain a slave for another 45 years. But if his sixth year comes out in the 43rd year of the Yovel cycle, and then he gets his ear pierced, well, he's only a slave for another 7 years, and he goes free. So it's only until the Yovel, and that's that. Because 50 years is considered to be forever. It's a long time. So, it's considered what?
At that time, yeah.
It's considered to be
like when he leaves after the 50 years, wherever that comes, can he take his wife and children even then?
Nope.
And I don't think the other one would want him. Okay,
we will discuss this further, Ms. Hashem, next time. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.